Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
So my presentation is entitled, Too Important to be Offended, What the Doctor Must Ask. It draws on my reflections, both as linguist and medical educators in clinical communication. I will use doctor-patient consultation to exemplify and explore the interplay between freedom of speech and offense, which can be found also in other professional settings. The title itself seems to suggest that in the face of health concerns, patients and doctors may overlook and tolerate speeches that may otherwise be considered offensive. However, this apparent acceptance prompts a deeper examination of the more nuanced dynamics at play. That's why I put a question mark in the title. As a linguist and a medical educator, I'm interested in the interplay between language use and a social interaction. The dynamic between doctors and patients is not unique to medicine, but extends to other professional contexts as many of us navigate or will navigate professional settings. The discussion here holds relevance for all of us. By understanding how freedom of speech intersects with offense in these environments through the lens of sociolinguistics, we may be able to find a way to foster more respectful and effective communication when we exercise our freedom of speech. A doctor-patient consultation is inherently a communicative event. Research indicates that 60 to 80% of a GP consultation involves talking between the doctor and patient. Communication plays a pivotal role in various aspects, including the doctor gathering information, providing explanations, and facilitating informed decision-making. The doctor's primary objective during a consultation is to gather comprehensive information, assess the patient's situation, and make an informed diagnosis. You may have heard about patient-centered care. So this concept means that we have to place the patient at the heart of the healthcare. The approach requires doctors to establish trusting partnerships with their patients, fostering open and honest communication. So effective communication is essential for building these partnerships and ensuring that patients are heard, respected, and involved in their care. In order to understand the communication in doctor-patient consultations, we have to understand how we talk to each other and achieve shared understanding. Conversational communication does not just happen when people begin to talk to each other. Each communicative event or encounter is a temporal and a spatial moment of our ongoing experience of the world. It is closely linked with what has happened in the past up to this moment and will shape what will happen a moment later. This diagram illustrates how the interlocutors or the speakers in a conversation use the three building blocks of their pre-existing knowledge to construct their communication. There are the social cultural knowledge, institutional knowledge, and linguistic knowledge. These three knowledge sets interact dynamically to shape the flow of conversation, the interpretation of our messages, and the construction of shared meanings. They determine both the content of the communication, that is, what we say, and its form, how we say it. While this diagram can also explain written communication, today I just wanted to focus on the in-person, face-to-face interaction. So we gain social-cultural knowledge through our memberships in various social groups, such as our family, our profession, our gender, or our education. We have multiple identities that coexist and interact with each other, according to the context, the situation where the talk is taking place. Institutional knowledge is, in effect, part of the broader sociocultural knowledge but it is more specific and tailored to particular institutional settings, such as in a classroom, medical consultation, or court hearing. This specialized knowledge becomes relevant when we engage in a specific institutional activity. Sometimes it can override the influence of the general sociocultural knowledge. For example, in a classroom, where the teacher says to a student who just answered a question, "No, incorrect, who's next?" The student is not likely to take it offensive or be offended. But if the same words are used among friends, you can imagine that, that can be perceived as rather offensive. The last but not least, the linguistic knowledge. It is about the grammar, vocabulary, and context-specific meanings of a particular language. It is the vehicle through which the other two types of knowledge are materialized in a conversation. It determines how we encode and decode verbal and nonverbal cues, enabling us to construct and interpret meanings. In any conversation, each participant brings with them a unique set of a sociocultural, institutional, and linguistic knowledge. While some of the knowledge is shared between the interlocutors, other aspects remain distinct. The greater the overlap in their knowledge sets, the smoother the conversation is likely to flow. Another important observation here is that only a subset of an individual's entire knowledge system is actively engaged in any given social interaction. The specific knowledge that becomes relevant and utilized during a conversation is determined by the context. So context is a very important concept in social linguistics. It plays a critical role in determining which aspects of an individual's knowledge system would become relevant, appropriate, and actively deployed during the interaction. An institutional context, such as in the medical consultations, defines the agenda, structure, and power dynamics of the conversation. The patient seeks medical care, while the doctor is entrusted to provide it. The conversation typically flows in a loosely prescribed sequence, from greetings and history taking to physical examination, diagnosis, treatment planning, and closure. Institutional contexts also dictate the distribution of power between interlocutors. The health professionals generally hold more power than their patients because of their specialized knowledge, authority in decision-making, and a status as a healthy individual in comparison to the patient as a sick person. This context also influences the language used, with a certain level of formality and adherence to professional norms being expected. In other words, the context of a medical consultation imposes constraints on the doctor's freedom of speech, requiring them to adhere to professional and ethical guidelines. Such limitations are codified by the regulatory bodies like the General Medical Council or the GMC, and embedded in legal frameworks of the state. Failure to comply with these regulations by the doctors can lead to serious consequences, including legal repercussions. So a bit more on the duty of the doctors. According to the GMC, or the General Medical Council, the doctors should make the care of the patient their first concern. They should provide a good standard of practice and care. They should keep their professional knowledge and skills up to date. They should recognize and work within the limits of their competence. All of these responsibilities are set for the purpose of keeping patients safe and maintaining high quality of care. Effective communication is a cornerstone of the doctor-patient relationship. Doctors should treat patients as individuals and respect their dignity. Treat patients politely and considerately. Respect a patient's right to confidentiality. So as a doctor, you cannot just discuss about your patients freely. You should give patients the information they want or need in a way that they understand. That means that the format of the language the doctor can use is also limited. And this guide goes on to talk about the requirements that doctors should never discriminate their patients and colleagues, never abuse patients' trust or the public's trust in the profession. Doctors are personally accountable for their professional practice and must always be prepared to justify their decisions and actions. So to achieve all these in one consultation is not easy. Doctors need to balance being clear and accurate with being sensitive and empathic when they talk to patients. Sometimes they have to ask very personal and sensitive questions or give bad news about the diagnosis and treatment. If they're too vague or indirect, they can cause confusion and distrust. But if they're too blunt or harsh, they can hurt the patient's feelings and damage the relationship. But because of the urgency of a patient's health, maybe as patients, we're more likely to forgive some blunt and harsh words. That's actually a question I want everybody to think about. So the medical context may have formed a bubble within which the doctor and patient have certain level of allowance to say something that would have been considered offensive otherwise. The doctor and the patient are focused on the health problems in hand. They may achieve a mutual understanding that the priority in the conversation is about patients' well-being. Therefore, they do not take offense or expect too much of a politeness being practiced by both people. In other words, it's too important to be offended. But is it always true? Remember, we still have like 7% of the people who think it's equally offensive when they're asked these questions by the doctor. And so the answer is probably not quite true. As I mentioned earlier, the doctor and patient bring in different sets of institutional, sociocultural, and linguistic knowledge. The discrepancies between the two knowledge sets unavoidably create different expectations and assumptions about what is acceptable or appropriate in a situation. I'll give you one more example, which can be quite fun to watch. This is a simulated doctor-patient consultation. Does that look familiar? Yeah, I can see some very sympathetic facial expressions while I was playing the video. In this consultation, you'll probably agree with me that the doctor in the video is doing his job by telling the patient his truthful judgment of the situation and the fact that he's just got a sore throat. She only needs paracetamol, and there isn't much he can do about it. He even apologized for the patient's long waiting, so he seemed attentive to the patient's emotions as well. The patient was concerned that she may pass the disease to the kid, and she wouldn't be able to work. And he provided assurance that was less likely to happen, but there was no guarantee. And her job was not likely to be affected by the sore throat. That's what he said. She asked for a sick note, but he couldn't give. She then asked for a private note, for which the doctor obviously would have to charge her £12 because it's not part of the NHS. These are all very important messages the patient needs to hear. And the doctor communicated it to her concisely and accurately. But is he doing a good job? Can he do it differently? Why is the patient getting more and more agitated? She was clearly rather offended at the end, almost wanted to take some defensive actions, as you can tell. But instead of doing that, she very sensibly walked out of the room. To answer these questions, we have to understand how people get offended more generally. So the politeness theory in sociolinguistics may shed some light on this issue. Politeness is defined as the efforts on redressing the affronts to a person's self-esteem or effectively claiming positive social values in social interactions. The desired positive image one wishes to project in the public is known as face. So you probably familiar with the expression, I lost my face, I'm losing face, right? So that has to do with the Plotinus theory. According to Bruno Levinson back in the 1980s, face is a social concept that refers to a person's sense of self-worth and social standing. We all have the desire to maintain our face in social interaction and minimize face-threatening acts against us. This can be achieved by maintaining both our positive and negative faces. Positive face refers to our desire to be respected and approved by other people. It has to do with our sense of belonging. Negative face, on the other hand, is our desire to be free from imposition and interference from others. This has to do with our autonomy. Now let's look back to the consultation we just saw. You can see that both the patient's positive and negative faces were undermined. She asked for some antibiotics at the start of the consultation. That was declined. She raised a concern, including her fear for the children to catch the virus from her and her inability to work. But again, those ideas were dismissed by the doctor. This became most obvious at the end of the consultation when the doctor said, I mean, you have just got a sore throat. It's just something we all get from time to time. When the patient reiterated that she could lose her job, the doctor made an accusatory remark, calling the patient's concern as grand staging. This not only diminishes the patient's judgment about her condition, but also questions her social standing as an honest and reasonable person. So the patient's positive face was threatened. By denying patient's request for medication and for sick note, the doctor also threatened the patient's negative face for imposing his judgment, interfering against the patient's autonomy. Additionally, the 12 pounds charge, while reasonable in itself, added another layer of unwanted burden on the patient. These combined face-threatening acts provide ample justification for the patient to feel offended, irritated, and angry. So this example also tells us that any kind of a disagreement is potentially face-threatening and consequently leads to offense. Even within the context of medical consultation, where the doctor seems to have the authoritative specialist knowledge, achieving mutual understanding on diagnosis and treatment cannot be assumed. And therefore, there's always the potential for the patient to feel denied and offended. This could prompt them to take actions to defend their face, which in turn may offend the doctor, as we can see in the latter part of the consultation. Medical consultation is actually full of a potential face-threatening acts. A diagnosis can make the patient feel that they are labeled or categorized as if they are different from other people, or that they are defined by their illnesses, such as the diabetic patient, the blind patient, or the cancer patient. This can be especially difficult if the diagnosis is associated with a social stigma or discrimination. This is threatening the patient's self-esteem, self-worth, and a sense of a belonging desired in their positive face. Patients may feel like they are losing control over their lives. A diagnosis can be a reminder that a patient is vulnerable and that their health is not entirely in their own control. This can be especially difficult for patients who are used to being independent and self-resilient, which threatens their autonomy. Patients may feel like they are being judged or blamed for their illness, or that they've been judged for their lifestyle choices. This can be especially hurtful if the patient feels like they have done everything they can to stay healthy. And patients may not understand the diagnosis. If the doctor does not explain the diagnosis clearly, or if the patient does not have access to the accurate information, they may feel confused or overwhelmed. All of these events threaten the patient's positive and negative faces, causing negative emotions in them. So these situations are not just true in medical consultations. Our reactions to faith-threatening acts in any argument, debate, or discussion share similarities. When we're expressing our opinions of what is perceived as a fact, we're actually imposing our value judgment over them. If somebody disagrees with us, they're also disagreeing with our values, and therefore are faith-threatening or potentially offensive. And our own expression of such beliefs in these opinions and perceived facts are threatening other people's faces or offending them, even though it is not in our attention. You may have heard about this expression, as you can see in the slides. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words may never hurt me. But psychologists Greenwell and Dennerick pointed out that this is not always the case. Instead, they say, while attack is an important instigator of aggressive behavior, it appears that the physical discomfort expressed by a person may be subordinate to the symbolic elements, so the linguistic impoliteness, that are incorporated in that attack. And linguist Jonathan Culpepper further points out that face-threatening act is an emotional reflex. It has emotional consequences for at least one participant in the conversation, typically the target. But often, the producer of the impoliteness, or in other words, the offender as well. If you think back to the videoed consultation, the doctor is observably getting uneasy during the consultation as well. In the debate about freedom of speech, there is a call for people to develop resilience. We have been told not to be oversensitive, so we can engage with disagreements better. Well, I agree with this statement, and I think it's very important. I feel that we also need to be mindful that controlling our emotions is easily said than done. When we feel offended, our brains release a surge of hormones such as the cortisol and adrenaline. These hormones are the evolutionary adaptation that prepare our bodies for the fight or flight response, which is a natural defense mechanism that helps us deal with danger, but they also make it difficult for us to control our emotions. We can learn to regulate our automatic reactions, but whether we will succeed depends on various factors, such as how close we are to the offensive topic and whether we have negative experience of this topic. Let's do another experiment. I love experiments. This activity may cause some discomfort or anxiety, so I do apologize for that. And if you feel any distress, feel free to come to speak to me after the session. So these words are commonly found in medical context. Look at these words and notice how they make you feel. Do some of them make your stomach flutter? Do you find it harder to discuss some of them than the others? This happens because some words evoke a stronger emotional response than others. These words seem very neutral and even factual, but we consciously and unconsciously associate them with our personal experience and the social stigma attached to these words. This is how we make sense of the world around us. It is more difficult for us to talk about some of these topics rationally and calmly if we have negative associations with them. For example, have a look at the word positive. It may be a welcome word for many people, but not for somebody who has just received a positive test result for an incurable illness. If somebody was teased in the past because of their height, the word short may bring back painful memories, so talking about the height may be upsetting for them. So this exercise wants to show that it is not always easy for us to have an objective and a rational discussion. It depends on our background and experiences. What seems not a big deal to somebody may not be the same to another. We should not jump to the conclusion to call somebody oversensitive if they feel uncomfortable or offended by a certain topic. We should respect their feelings and try to understand their perspectives. Just like in any institutional context, the doctor and patient are not on equal footing. Doctor usually has the specialized knowledge, but the patient does not have it. So the doctor should take the responsibility to make sure that the patient is properly and adequately informed. A lot of the times a patient gets angry because they don't understand the information they are given. The doctor can come across as patronizing if they don't take time and effort to make the explanation accessible to the patient. There is also a power asymmetry. The doctor often holds a position of authority, which can make it challenging for patients to assert their boundaries. Although in the last decade or so, medical professionals have been trying to break this imbalance and create a more equal relationship with their patients, research still shows that more powerful doctor still remains. A lot of the times, just like the situation you saw in the video consultation, the decision-making is largely in the hands of the doctor. It is a lot easier for the doctor to refuse to engage with the negotiation over decision-making about the patient's treatment plan. And the patient can be left with little choice, but only to accept what is offered to them by the doctor. Another important factor affecting the relationship between the doctor and patient is patient's vulnerability due to their illnesses and the need for care. Some patients are in pain when they are having conversations with their doctor, and all patients need something from the doctor, but not the other way around. Now we can reasonably argue that in a medical consultation, doctors have more liberty to choose not to be offended, but not so much the patients. It's easier for the doctor to say, "You have just had a sore throat, not a big deal," and that is a fact. But not easy for the patient, after hearing this, not to get offended. Power asymmetry is not unique to doctor-patient relationship. It is present in many institutional contexts where the interlocutors have different levels of authority or influence. For example, in the classroom, students are not on equal footing with their lecturers. In a workplace, managers have more power than employees. Even in everyday conversation, we find ourselves in asymmetrical relationships with others because of our differential sociocultural backgrounds, which may bring about privileges or the lack of them. So the point I'm trying to make, of course, is not to restrict freedom of speech, but just to be aware of these underlying power imbalances that can affect the communication, that can affect the communication participants differently. Some may be more vulnerable to harm than others. An important part of maximizing freedom of speech or freedom of expression is to enable each other to develop the skills to express ourselves in a kind, empathic, and compassionate manner. In today's culturally diverse society, developing cultural competency has become an essential requirement for professionalism because it encompasses the ability to understand, appreciate, and interact effectively with people from different cultures. Through cultural competency training, we gain the tools to navigate the complexity of a human communication and engage with others in a sensitive and inclusive manner. Cultural competency development empowers us to recognize and address the underlying power imbalances that can hinder effective communication and allows us to identify and dismantle our own biases, assumptions, and prejudices, creating more equitable space for dialogue. In medicine and healthcare, the regulators such as the GMC has specific requirements for medics to develop cultural competency. They require the doctors to be kind, courteous, and respectful. And I think these words apply in all social interactions. Now I have another video to show you a different situation between the doctor and patient. And I think the situation here is slightly better managed than the previous one you saw. So in this consultation, you see a lot of the elements that you have seen in the previous consultation. The doctor was breaking the bad news to the patient, and there wasn't much the doctor can do with the diagnosis. And yet, the consultation is managed very differently. She made use of a verbal and a nonverbal cues to create a caring and empathic atmosphere for this patient who is transiting from a healthy person to a cancer patient. As we discussed earlier, a new diagnosis often entails a loss of control and the imposition of external labels. It can also associate the patient with a certain undesirable social stigma. By understanding this, this doctor is able to stay in control of her own emotions and avoids taking offense, even when the patient enacts a face-threatening act, such as questioning her diagnosis at the end. She was, "Are you sure? Are you certain? Do you want to check again?" And she wasn't offended, and she was there with the patient throughout the time. So to conclude, freedom of speech is a fundamental human right, but it's not absolute, especially when it's taking place in institutional context. Such a context shapes the boundaries and limitations on the content and the means of communication. Sometimes the institutional context may require us to speak up, even if it causes offense to others. However, we should also be aware that words have power and impact. They can hurt people who are originally marginalized or oppressed by the dominant society and system. Therefore, when we exercise our freedom of speech, we should also be kind and compassionate. We should ask ourselves, is this the right time and place to say what I want to say? Are we on an equal footing? Or is there a power asymmetry? Or a differential experience that affects how we understand and express ourselves in a certain situation? Can I say what I want to say differently so I can minimize harm and maximize understanding? We should always take time to build a trust and a safe and caring space for difficult conversations, as this can help us use our freedom of speech responsibly and respectfully. By doing so, we can work towards creating a more just and equitable society where everyone's voice is not only heard, but also celebrated. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.